Well, hi again. This is Bob Brundage. And today we're in Danbury, Connecticut. The date is November the 9th, 1996. And today we're talking with Dave Haas, who dropped off the interstate long enough to stop. He's on his way to a dance down in Katona, New York. And Dave comes from up in East Hampton, Connecticut, up in the center of the state. And we stopped by to talk with Dave and find out what's been going on in your life. Dave, tell us all about it.
Well, I was born in Meriden back in 1937. I had two brothers. I was pretty active in the church, and as I got older, I was in BMLA and all those other organizations that everybody gets involved in, Scouts. And I was still in high school, and we had a summer cottage at over at Lake Pogrebog in East Hampton. And one year, the next-door neighbor, well, it was one house removed, but he came over and asked me if I could have room so he could have a square in. His name was J. Bard McNulty, and he was a professor at Trinity College and actually head of the English department. And he had just taken lessons from Al Brundage, to learn how to call. And so he wanted to get some experience, and he had two cottages on his property, so he had no room at all. And I talked to my parents, and they said, sure, why not? So we had a dance on a Wednesday night in 1951. We had just one, and we had quite a number of kids. We probably had 50, 60 people in the yard. And it went so well that year that the next year we decided to have maybe a couple. So we did, and it kept getting bigger. And the third year, we decided we were going to have one every week. And that was the year that I began to get interested in calling, because I danced with Bard for, you know, since 51. Although not overly frequently, but we got together in the wintertime a couple times and had a little get-together. And so I started calling that summer, and Bard had me practice my patter calling. And of course, back then it was very difficult to get hoedown records, so I took a bunch of polka records and I learned how to patter by using polka records.
Uh-huh.
And by that third year and for the next few years, we were getting really big crowds. I mean, we were getting 250, 300 people in our backyard.
Wow.
And I remember soda was a nickel back then, and we had those soda cap removers all over the yard on trees. But we had a good time, and by that time, a lot of the year-round kids, you know, the East Hampton kids, were coming to our dances too. And I think it was in 56, I got a call from a couple who lived in East Hampton, and they said, oh, I got to go back here a minute.
All right.
Anyway, those kids that started coming to my summer dances, they called me up and said, asked me if I would come to East Hampton, because they still lived in Meriden, and if I would come over and do their Friday night thing. They had a kind of an open night at the school when any of the kids could do anything they want within reason. So they asked the people in the school if they could have a room and we could square dance in. And so they gave us a library, and it was a multi-level room. So there wasn't a lot of room for a whole lot of squares. But we had probably two or three squares. And that went very well. And the next fall, I got a call from a couple. And they said they wanted me to come over and teach them what the kids were doing, because the kids were having so much fun. And I said, well, I said, I really, you know. Well, I said, first, you need to get a group together. She said, well, we've got 24 couples ready to go. And it was all set, and everybody knew that they were going to do it ahead of time. And I said, well, I never really called for adults. I said, I don't know if I, you know, would be capable of teaching. And that couple that contacted me said, well, I think it was her father-in-law had taken lessons from Earl Johnston. And they had recorded the lessons. And they said, well, we'll let you borrow the tapes. so you could hear, you know, how the lessons were going. And so I got a hold of the tapes, and I'd sit in my room every night, and I'd take every word from the tape and put it down on paper. And that was my teaching manual at that point. So I really learned how to teach adults by using Earl Johnson's class tapes that he was using.
You better look out now. You know, Earl's going to look for royalties on you.
Yeah, right. He already knows it.
Oh, okay.
So I started the class, and that was my first club. And I believe the club graduated, the first class graduated in 1956, or I can't remember. It's either 56 or 57. And the club lasted about 18 years, and we were getting to the point where it was hard to attract crowds, because at that point, there were a whole bunch of new clubs springing up all over, and people, at the point, they really didn't want to travel. And so as more clubs grew up around us, we began to lose our crowds. And although the club was not in trouble financially, we just decided there was time to maybe put it to bed, because we were kind of out in the middle of nowhere at that point. There weren't too many, you know, highways.
Right.
So, and I can't remember the exact year, but anyway, we had a great time. And during that time, I was asked to start another club in Colchester, which was called the Sea Twirlers. And I have no idea when that was, but it had to be in the early 60s. But back in the late 50s, early 60s, square dancing really began to grow a lot here. And when I first started calling, it was pretty much traditional with a little bit of Western style thrown in. And then as we went along, it became more and more standardized. And the thing I remember back then was Square Through was the hottest thing on Main Street. And we thought that was pretty good. And things went along really well. And I got to be fairly popular. And I was to the point where I was out calling 13 or 14 nights in a row, and then I'd get a night off, and then another 15 or 18 in a row, and then have a night off. And I really didn't have much time, and I wasn't home with my family. And it got to the point where I either had to decide to go full-time or back off and stay with my family and watch it grow.
Right.
And I decided to back off.
Okay.
And I'm kind of glad I did now, because right after that gas crunch started, and you know, I said to myself, boy, am I glad I made the decision I did.
Right.
But it's dancing's been good to me. And I've called for several clubs as club caller. I called for a club in Southington, and then they merged and became the Central Valley Squares, and I became their first caller. And they danced in Plainville, I believe. But you know, I've been around a lot. I started a square dance week up at Papoose Pond, and again, I can't remember the year. But we ran that for about 25 years. And we would get upwards of 30, 35 squares at that week. It didn't start that big, but it got to that point.
Sure, sure.
And we always had two or three callers on staff, and it really was a fun week. We, when we first started, we danced on the cement floor, and everybody was about Wednesday, there'd be a haze around the auction floor, you know, the dust. And so they finally decided to expand the barn, and when they did, they were going to just, you know, make it bigger and extend out the end. And when they got through and they broke the wall down, they found out that there was a difference in level of the floor. The original barn had two sills, and the new barn only had one sill.
Yeah.
So he felt that it was more reasonable and less expensive to put a floating floor in, a wood floor, rather than, you know, fill that all with cement. So that's how we ended up getting that beautiful floor up there.
Okay.
And as I say, and then I started a weekend in East Hill Farm with Ed Ruddy. Again, it's about 25 years ago that we did that.
That long.
And we're still going. This will be our 25th anniversary this coming March. So I began to get popular, and I was traveling as far west as Ohio, Indiana. I was going to Maryland, Virginia area. I'd been to Florida a couple times. I've been to Canada three or four times. So I really began to get around. And then, of course, when the gas crunch came, everybody had to change their philosophy about how much they could afford and where we could afford to go based on what fees we could attract. So the traveling pattern changed then fairly drastically, and we got more dates at home than we used to get away from home. And so that I think that changed the trend of the national callers too, traveling.
Yeah.
There wasn't the number of traveling callers after that we used to get.
Yeah.
Maybe they have anywhere from 10, 12 a year around in the area. And that pretty well got down to maybe one or two or three at the most.
Well, getting back, who were some of the people that had an early influence on you outside of Earl Johnson's tape?
Well, Al did, because I got to know Al. And Stan Burdick. Stan was the director at the Y in Middletown.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that Stan used to live in Connecticut.
That's right.
He was a member of Connecticut College. So
that's right. Yeah. That's right. And he, so we had a lot of dances there. We had the callers dance out there sometimes, and we'd have dances. And I don't know why we had them, but there was five or six callers that would come. And one of the dances I remember, Pop Houston used to hold down in Deep River. It was a benefit for something. I can't remember. It was Girls Friendly Society, or it was a group like that. And every year we donated time and go down there. And we had pretty good crowds because, you know, all the callers in the area would donate time. And Kip Benson was down there. And Pop Houston, who was sort of a caller. He was a minister. But he used to call.
Yeah.
He had kind of gruff voice, but he was an excellent teacher.
Right.
And so one day when I was down there, he introduced me as Dave Hash Hess, and I thought that was kind of different. So I just kept that as my sort of nickname all these years. And, of course, everybody calls Hash now. But back then I probably was one of the first guys who began to call Hash in this area, because I had seen Les Gocher a couple of weekends, and his pattern kind of intrigued me.
Right.
Because back when I first started, actually when I first started calling, a tip was three numbers. It was a sing call, then a pattern call, and then a sing call.
Right.
But the pattern call might as well have been a sing call, because they had an opener, and then twice for the heads, the same thing, and then an open, a middle break, and then twice for the sides, the same thing, and then
right.
a closer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we did dance those three, and then as round dancing became a little bit more popular, dancers said, hey, maybe we ought to go to two numbers in a tip rather than three.
Right.
And I think that's basically when it went from three to two.
Yeah.
And it's always traditionally been, you know, a pattern followed by a sing call.
Yeah.
Although once in a while, you know, now these days we do a couple sing calls, maybe the last tip or whatever.
Right.
Well, I know you've been very active in the Connecticut College Association and other New England-wide organizations like conventions and so forth. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I've been active both in NECA as treasurer and I think secretary way back, and I've been either president.
For the record, that's the New England Council of College Association.
Yeah. And then I was treasurer and president for the Connecticut Callers, I don't know how many times.
I know.
It's got to be, I have to have served at least 10 or 12 total years on the board. Oh, it's more than that, because the last time I was corresponding secretary, I think, was there for 12 years. So it's got to be 20 something years, I guess.
Right.
I don't know. It seems like a long time.
Right.
But one of the things that I somehow got into was Jerry Helt came through. One time, not Jerry Helt, short guy, Dave Taylor.
Okay.
And he did a progressive square, and I thought that was pretty good, so I wanted to learn how to do that. So I went home, and I got nine squares of pieces of paper, boy one, girl one, you know, or set A, boy one, girl. So I had 9, 72 pieces of paper. and I kept moving these guys to see where they'd go. And then finally it struck me that it was just like doing a sing call.
Right.
As long as I did once the heads, once the sides, it was like getting your opposite way.
Right.
So I've been sort of gotten known in this area as the one to do progressive squares with. And generally, for a long time, Charlie Baldwin had me do it at the New England conventions.
Right.
I mean, years. And then they changed the format, and of course, Charlie sort of backed out of it. And so I didn't do it for a long time, and now they're starting to ask me again to do it. Well, in the last 5 years they have.
Right.
But I always do it at the Connecticut Festival, and I try to do it whenever I get a good crowd at the dances, but those crowds right now are not to the point where you generally can do it, because most of the clubs, get anywhere from 3 to maybe 10 squares. And if the hall fits and we have 9 squares, I usually try to do it.
Right. Somewhere along the line, you were going to start to include exploding squares.
I did that almost right away.
Did you really?
Yeah, once I realized how the progressive square is so simple, then I started to combine one with the other. And I think Dave did that same thing. He may not have, but somewhere I got the idea of the exploding squares, and I do that. So I do a combination of both when I say I do a progressive squares. I usually do a part of an exploding square routine and the progressive squares.
Well, I think Ed Gilmore was the one that came out with exploding squares first,
that
I know of.
Could have been.
And I remember Jerry Helt did come to me. He did a workshop at Canadian College with progressive squares.
That could be where it is. Somehow I seem to think it was Dave Taylor, but it might have been Jerry Hill.
Well, either way.
Because I admire both of those guys.
Yeah, all right. So, how about the New England Convention?
I've been on almost every one of them. I missed the first few because I really wasn't that active. And in the New England area, I was active in the state, and I can't remember all the guys that we used to be in the association. I know Earl and Al was in the association, and Bob Brundage, and myself, and Al Brozek, and Stan Burdick, of course. And
Jim Murray.
There's so many guys, and I just forget them. I can remember dancing at the Roost over in Waterbury. We'd have some of our callers dances there, like a convention, but back then it was really small because nobody was doing anything. Then the association started to say, well, let's go to where the dancers were. So we would have like 6 locations all the state, but all the same day, and each caller would be assigned to a hall somewhere, and we'd all go call. But the problem is we never made much money because everything was so expensive. You had to pay all the halls and all the everything else, the policemen and everything. So it ended up to be not too profitable.
It was a good idea, but it didn't work.
Yeah. Well, I may have been the one that was sort of instrumental in getting it all together because I don't remember who the chairman of the convention was that year, but I know what it was. And the dancers were on their own, and we were running our own, and the random dancers were doing their own. And I said, why don't we all get together and just do one? So it took about 2 years to get that put together, but we finally did, and we had some really big and fun conventions.
Right.
That's one of the things I sort of forget that I did, but I did do it.
Right.
Of course, the dancer got the credit for it because he was the one that finally came up with the chairman and everybody else. But.
Then you've been affiliated with Caller Lab since its early days.
Yep, I think 75. I didn't go the first 2 years. I wasn't invited. I don't know why, but that's just one of those things.
Yeah.
I probably wasn't at that point. I was well known here in the Northeast, but I have a feeling that maybe across the country, a lot of guys didn't know who I was. Because I really was a local caller.
Yeah, right.
Rather than a national traveling caller.
Well, we all were at one time or another.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. So, what about any other big festivals that you're proud to have been associated with?
I've called it a lot of festivals. A lot of a lot of them over in New York State. I did quite a few of those. I was the first caller for the Flaming Leaves Festival, which is up in Lake Placid, New York. Mm-hmm. And I think the first year we only had, I don't remember, it was like maybe 600 or 800 people. But they danced on a cement floor, you know, which was the rink. And they gave me a plaque, you know, and I would still have it, except all my trophies and plaques and everything was burned up in a fire.
Oh, dear.
Because I had that little barn at my house, and we used to have workshops there and some classes there. And I used to have one thing I should say is that I started a group called Experimental Squares. And back then, there were no lists, but there were a lot of note services coming out with the new calls. And I would get 3 or 4 note services. Of course, none of them would have the same calls in them, so we have many to pick from. We danced twice a month, and we called Experimental Squares. And we would sort of review all the calls. And the ones that kind of looked good, we kind of, you know, we started to use in the area. And some of the people who are still around who danced there with me say that, you know, if it wasn't for me, they wouldn't be dancing a dance today or challenging, you know.
Right.
And a lot of the stuff we did back then, which is sort of routine, is now challenge material. But, you know, they came and went, and some we kept, and some actually became part of the list that we have today.
Right.
But it was fun experimenting, and the dancers were all pretty good dancers, and they had a good sense of whether something would go or not, along with my opinion. But we usually agreed. If I looked at it, and I didn't particularly care about it, but I showed them everything, they would tend to agree with my philosophy in general. Once in a while, I'd be surprised, and they'd say, oh, that's really good, you know.
Yeah.
And I, from looking at it, I would say, oh, I'm sure that's good. But anyway, it was a fun thing, and we had that going. Well, probably 10 or 15 years anyway. Mm-hmm. But that was all before lists. And then when the lists came out, that sort of faded away.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you know, there was other things for people to do at that point.
Right. Okay. You're not associated with ACA?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah, I belong to call that band ACA.
Okay, good.
And I joined ACA mainly because I thought they had some pretty good ideas about, you know, where we're going today. And
right.
I kind of get a little upset with Holland once in a while when I think about them sort of not being willing to at least look at the situation and sit together with ACA, you know.
Yeah.
Because I think we all have to agree, whether it's Holland or ACA, I think that at the end we can't have two different programs. But I think today the programs are not doing what they originally set out to do. I think, I'm sure they've changed or fixed the problem back when we were just getting just whole lots of calls, you know. And it served the purpose for a while, but then when the list became popular, it kind of split the dancers up. And, you know, in the beginning, everybody kind of danced together, but as the list became sort of standard stuff, a lot of your mainstream dances, or what was then mainstream, moved into the plus, and of course then up to the advanced. So we don't have really dances where all the dancers dance together anymore.
Yeah.
And I think it might be time to step back and look and see if maybe a one-level program. Of course, you're not going to eliminate a dance or challenge, but but I think that, you know, the people who are dancing a marginal plus could very easily dance mainstream and not miss anything.
Yeah.
I read Jerry Story's philosophy on his one-level system, and I pretty much agree with him, except that I think in order to please more of the dancers, that we should probably drop some of the mainstream and some of the plus and come out with a single level. And the reason I say that is because, you know, we've been changing these lists as we've been going along. Why not change them again? I mean, there's nothing magic about mainstream per se. And I, talking about mainstream, I think the name mainstream is what killed the whole program. Because, I mean, we're all sort of competitive, you know, and everybody doesn't want to be what just everybody else does. They just want to kind of get a little better. And I think that's the name sort of, you know, did that. I almost am sorry we didn't keep the name Square Dancing or Club Level. And then call it Plus and Advanced. But the general consensus was that you ought to call it mainstream because that's where everybody is. Well, once you did that, then everybody didn't want to be. But I would like to see everybody back together. And I think the clubs would grow again. I really do.
I was interested in some of the other fellows I've interviewed. Some of the comments, like the Japanese people, for example. The people that are in the challenge still support the mainstream dancers.
That doesn't happen here in the East, no. If the advanced people will support clubs pretty well. It's not 100%. But I remember when I had an experimental squares group, my rule was they had to be very active in their club or they couldn't come. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they supported their clubs, obviously. And but I think, and I've done that with some of the A1 groups I've had. I said, I won't teach it unless you're, you know, belong to and support. You know, at that point it would be mainstream club or plus club.
Right.
But I have not done a lot with A1, and it's okay. But when it gets up into A2, I don't know. I just sort of think it's not as fun as it is to dance. Just to dance and have fun and dance to the music.
What about other hobbies? I mean, you don't have any time
I didn't really have any. No, I used to collect matchbook covers when I was a kid. And, of course, once I started to crawl, I pretty much stopped doing almost every hobby. I really don't have the hobbies for anything.
Right.
But I never played golf, and I was never much into sports. Even in school, I used to play a little baseball. Right. I played some soccer. But my interests were more in, you know, when I saw what Square Dancing was and I got the bug to call, that took all my time. Because even in the wintertime, even though I was still in school, I would spend more time practicing pattern and making notes from Earl's tapes than I would do studying. So.
Right.
I mean, I graduated, and I graduated okay, but and I did go to college, but I didn't finish college because my dad had been brought into the insurance business by my grandfather on my mother's side, and then my grandfather, you know, brought him in, and then my father decided that he would bring me in, so I was starting to study electrical engineering at what was then Hilliard College, now the University of Hartford. And I decided, why take this if I'm going to work? So I changed and took a few business courses, and I think I'm a junior. I think I'm a junior, but I don't think I'll ever get my degree.
Uh-huh.
And I never bothered with an associate degree.
Yeah.
But again, I could have done it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, which leads us into your other vocation. You're now in the insurance business.
I have been for since I think 59 or 60, but I've been calling longer than I've been in insurance.
Is that right?
Yep. I think I was 15 or 16 when I started to call, and I remember when I first started to call, it was difficult because there weren't a whole lot of clubs in the area. Al Brundage had one, and then there was the Glastonbury Club, and I think the Middletown Club was in existence, but I was the youngest caller out there. And whenever I'd suggest anything or whatever, they'd say, don't tell us what to do. We're old enough to be your parents. So I had a difficulty in becoming a leader because of that. But I think they realized after a while that I was, you know, involved in the association. I sort of knew what was going on and what the trends were. So they began to listen to me. And once that happened, everything went along pretty smoothly.
Yeah.
But I can remember, when I was doing those kids at school, I decided I'd charge them 25 cents a head, and that was my pay to come from here in East Hampton back. But I can also remember back then when I used to call it, you know, like the MLA for Square Dance or another group, I'd charge them a whole $15. And that was a lot of money back then.
Sure.
And so, but I, it, you know, I've been through a lot of phases of square dancing, and I really think now, because of our society, the way we live, and our demands on both the husband and the wife, we need to have something that's more relaxing and more fun than it is to make it challenging. I mean, I can see a dancer after they danced a few years might want to go further, but back then we tried to satisfy every dancer, and we tried to incorporate, I don't want to say all levels, but before the levels, we tried to, you know. But one of the things back then, too, that I remember is if I called it Club A, they'd know that's kind of relaxed dance, and they could all come to that and dance without trouble. But if I called it Club B, that was going to be a little more tougher, you know, maybe more figures used during that dance, because I don't know why. It was just the club itself, I guess, and the ability of not only myself but other callers to call, you know, different kinds of dances depending on the crowd they drew. So we didn't every call a level, but, you know, people say, oh, let's go to so-and-so tonight because that's going to be a good dance. Mm-hmm. Or let's go to here because it's a fun dance. But it was really what we call probably a dance between basic and mainstream.
Right.
And but everybody went for a different reason back then. And as I say, Call a Lab, I think, really got together when the call, we just had an influx of new calls every time. And of course, every traveling caller, and that's where they came from, is the traveling caller. Each guy would have his own separate gimmick or whatever.
Yeah.
And the dancers would go, and then they come back and say, hey, we want to do that. And so we teach them, you know. But those days are gone, and I think we, as I say, we have to look now back to maybe regrouping and come up with a list that everybody can live with. And see if we can't bring it down to a moderate number of lessons. I remember when I first started calling, I think it was 8 lessons and maybe 10.
Yeah.
And then it got to 12 and 14 and 16, and then the real problems started.
Sure, right.
More and more and more classes.
Yeah. Have you ever been involved in round dancing at all?
Well, back when I first started, I used to teach the rounds. Of course, it was like the Teeth Down Mountain Stomp and Texas Wagner, I think, or I can't remember all the names because it's 43 years ago. And so, but the callers all used to do rounds, but not, you know, through every tip. They decide, you know, that they wanted to do something, and they'd get everybody up and teach it to everybody, and we do it. And then the round dancers started up, and I decided, because I was so busy calling square dance, that I really didn't want to carry around. So I stopped carrying them, you know, a while back after the round dance people, you know, really got going.
Right.
And almost every club would have either records or somebody doing rounds at the dances.
Right.
And it was kind of futile.
Now we just took a brief pause long enough to turn over the tape. So we were just talking about round dancing. How about our current popular line dancing?
Back then, line dancing really wasn't about. What we did do, almost every night, we did at least one contra. I can remember at every club dance we used to do at least one contra, sometimes two. And the dancers seemed to like that. And that part of it sort of faded away. And we just got to use them less and less, and all of a sudden nobody asked for them anymore. But I used to enjoy the contras. That was one of the fun things that we could do. As a matter of fact, you know, we as the callers could even get down there and dance, because once they learned the routine, we'd just jump in. And,
right.
You know. But I don't know if the line dancing has really hurt us. A lot of people think it does. I think it attracted a whole different set of people. I think,
sure,
in general, there are more single, not that they're all single, but more single people. But I think at this point they've ruined it like we ruined square dancing by just, you know, coming up with something new every time you turn around.
Right.
As a matter of fact, a couple of couples who took lessons with me 2 years ago, they came in kind of a group. They said that the year before they had taken line dancing, and they had a good time, but they really didn't enjoy it. And so they took lessons with me maybe 3 years ago. But anyway, they're still dancing very actively.
Right.
and are glad they got into square dancing.
Yeah. You don't cue any of them yourself?
Not anymore. I used to cue. When the round dancing first became really popular, I did cue.
Yeah.
And as I say, I did teach, and so I don't have too much difficulty around dancing today because I sort of knew the basics. And
yeah.
I learned easy. And
well, many of the clubs around the country are trying to incorporate line dancing sort of in place of round dancing or in addition to and so forth.
Yeah.
You're not involved in that at all.
No, I talked to some of the clubs about trying it, and a lot of them were reluctant to do it because they felt that there was going to be a phase out of the cures, and I didn't think it would be, and I don't think it's going to be at this point. And I think there's still clubs who may do some, some country line dancing. But back in the round dancing first started coming, we used to do a lot of line dancing.
Yeah.
Very simple stuff. And, I can't remember the names of them now, but another one was Amos Moses.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the Alley Cat and some of those. But they've been around for a long time. But for a long time, the line dances, the inscriptions got quite popular. But most people who are dancing today don't remember that.
Right.
But we used to do a lot of line dancing along with a couple.
Yeah. And we did circle mixtures.
Yeah.
Circle mixtures. It was a different program back in the old days.
It sure was.
But,
and, even today, college say, well, what's your system? I don't have a system because back then, you just learned as you went along. And
right.
I guess if I had to sit down and, think about it, I could probably come up with some kind of a system. But it would be, I'm sure, a mixture of everything.
Yeah.
Because as the activity grew, I grew with it.
Right.
I didn't start to call when it, like a caller starts today. I mean, he can't learn experience. There's no way, a lot of callers today can't really call a true traditional or fun night experience. They have to base it on what we know today as mainstream or basic calls.
Right.
But there's a lot of variety of stuff.
And, did you ever have any time to do any recording?
No. I was going to do it, and I talked about it a couple times with Grant, and I was talking to Earl about it. He said, well, you call up Grant and tell him I told you to call, and he'll let you do something. Well, I never did it. And so, but I'd like to someday before I get out of the activity. But when I hear some of the quality of stuff that goes down the tape of those records today,
it's true. Yeah.
It's atrocious. I wonder why the record companies allow it to go on. But I guess the callers pay for it, so they don't care.
Yeah. Well, I was talking this afternoon with Randy Page, and he was saying he couldn't understand how some of the record companies can release some of the things they do.
I would think it would give the record company a bad name. But
right.
So many of them do it, I guess. Of course, some of them are restricted, and they won't let anybody other than their regular staff guys go on. And so that they're sort of pre-chosen.
Right.
But, a lot of callers out there who want to record, and they just go to a studio, and and they do anything they want as long as they buy it.
Yeah.
The record companies made their money on it, I guess. And so.
Well, I heard Wade Driver, who has his own record company, of course, made the comment one time that if you come out with a record, it doesn't mean that you're a national caller necessarily.
No.
It means you've got $500.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And if you start your own record company, it doesn't mean that you're all that much of a hot shot. It means you've got $5,000.
Yeah, right.
To spend.
Yeah. Well, back 20 years ago or 25 years ago, it was a feather in your cap to record.
Sure.
Right. But now everybody does it.
Yeah. But, well, this has been a real interesting session, Dave. Most of the guys I've been talking with, I'm asking them to kind of give us a little overview of where do you think square dancing has been, and where do you think we are, and where do you think we're going?
Well, the only thing I know is from the 50s, but I know that in the late 40s, I think it was late 40s, that Al and a whole bunch of other national leaders got together and standardized the program. Because in New England, if you did a do-si-do in New Hampshire, it wasn't always the same as if you did it in do-si-do in Connecticut.
Right.
Some was left shoulder, some was right shoulder, and there was a lot of things that weren't standard.
Yeah.
And so those guys got together and pretty much standardized it, and that's what we called Western style square dancing. And I'm sure it evolved from, you know, what they were doing as traditional into, you know, getting more of the couples dancing rather than a visiting couple concept.
Right.
And it's slowly developed, and the old basics, you know, ladies chain right, left through, and circle left and right, those got incorporated, and then we started to get creative with the choreography.
Right.
And that's how it grew. But I think we hit our peak in probably the middle 60s to the early 70s. I think in 75 it began to sort of fade out. Not fade out, but it began more difficult to get classes, and
yeah,
people weren't staying as long as they did back then. I can remember the Belltown Squares Club, I think we had dancers, the average dancer stayed there 8-10 years at least, and some of them, they started with the club and they finished with the club when we closed it up. So
yeah,
it doesn't seem to be that way today. You get a class and you're lucky to keep half of them or 25% of them, and they don't usually last only a couple of years unless they get the bug to get going. And in the East here, it's difficult to find a dance that's not plus, or at least have enough plus in it so a mainstream dancer would have difficulty, you know,
right,
functioning and feel uncomfortable and therefore really doesn't enjoy dancing.
Right.
So, well, but, you know, I don't think it's ever going to fade away. I'm sure. Now, I've noticed myself, and I talked to a few of the other guys, we're beginning to get more and more one-night stands again. I mean, I do as many one-night stands I call, but, you know, for clubs. But I've been getting a lot of them lately,
yeah,
and which tells you that square dancing is fun, but it's not easy to sell. And the other problem is that because we've had so many people in and out of the program, and the people who leave, I'm sure leave for other than reasons than they got too busy or whatever. They just didn't enjoy it that much.
Right.
And, of course, they're out there unselling square dancing. We got more unsellers of square dancing, I think, than we got sellers, because everybody who goes through a club program quits, mm-hmm, because it's not their bag or not fun for them. That's what they tell the people, their friends. They say, oh, we tried that. You had to go to 9 and blah. You know, so I think we need to really think about what we're going to do next and try to come up with a program that's contemporary. And I know some of the guys are saying, oh, we shouldn't do anything with mainstream and just cut all the plus things. And at this point in the program, I'm not sure that's the answer. But I think we do need to whittle it down so you can teach it in 15, 20 weeks. And have everybody dance that level and make it so difficult. They've got to dance 2 or 3 years before they can go to the next level. They were saying, like, advanced shouldn't be A1 and A2. It should be advanced, period. And the callers need to stick with that. I mean, they can't keep calling the A1 and A, you know. I mean, if we're going to make the change, we've got to make it together. And the guys who are dancing A1s are going to have to stop it or make them learn the rest of the advanced program,
right,
and either that or go back to, you know,
yeah,
to whatever we call this next level.
Right.
And I'd like to see it either square dancing or club level, because it was club level for so long, and it worked fine.
I'd like to think that that would be kind of tough to do, to ask people who have gotten as far as advanced to go back and remain with the other program.
Well, I think some of them, I know some of the dancers who take advanced A1 workshops, they don't really dance A1. They dance some of A1. But I think if push came to show, I think that some of them would probably say, gee, maybe you ought to dance here, it's more fun.
And I think, but at the same time, though, that they advance ought to be a program where they don't follow the sort of soft, they want to, yeah, terrible terms, but,
right,
you know, easy stuff so that you get more. I think that we need to turn that triangle around so we get a good base of club-level dancers or the first entry level or whatever it is, because now we've got it just reversed. The tip of the triangle is upside down, and we have very little people on the basic level or the entry level and more into the advanced and challenged, and they're going to run out of people pretty soon, so
right,
the whole thing's going to collapse.
Right.
So I think we need to turn it around before, you know, well, we still have a chance and still have people in there to keep it going.
Yeah, I think we ought to think about, you know, what we should do. But I definitely think it should be whittled down and come up with a set of calls. And it doesn't have to be all mainstream or all plus or whatever, or all even basic. But and those programs are okay, but I think that Call Lab needs to maybe think back about the name, you know, of mainstream and change it to something that's more livable,
right,
with, or people are going to live with, I guess I should say.
Well, the thought I was thinking about, for people that have gotten as far as advanced, to now ask them to support something that's a much lower level, it's sort of an admission of defeat if they do.
Well, I suppose it is, but I think most of the people who are in the A1 end of advanced sort of realize that that's a necessity, that we do have to support the clubs and keep them going. I think most of them, you know, pretty much all of them belong to a plus club somewhere,
right,
or they're dancing regularly, you know, at the general level in that area,
yeah,
along with going to A1 dances. But even the A1 dances, I think they're starting to fade away a little bit, and those aren't well attended.
Yeah.
I think some people are getting tired of keep working at shopping at A1 and then can't go anywhere to dance it because,
yeah,
you know, the guys who have advanced dances usually call the whole program advanced. So if they're A1 dancers, they really can't cut the mustard if they go to an advanced dance.
Right.
And some of them may just decide that, well, I don't want to go into all that. Maybe I should, you know, do more with the club or do,
right,
more in that level. And, you know, I think we need to keep the more popular ones, the more frequently used ones.
Yeah.
And I know that every call has got their own, you know, favorite call, and every time you bring up a call to drop it, oh, that's my whole thing.
Yeah.
Well, I think if we're decent callers and we've got a head on our shoulder, we can learn to live without a figure. We can do something instead of, or
right,
we can talk it through, or, you know,
call it directionally.
Yeah, call it directionally. And I don't have any trouble with that. I just don't think people. I called a few dancers one time, and I called only mainstream, and I asked the dancers at refreshment if anybody knew what I did. There was only one person out of the whole crowd that said, "Yeah, you don't call any plus figures tonight." I said, "You're right, I call mainstream." But I made it very interesting, and most people didn't know.
Yeah.
So it's possible to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, if the callers all start to not call a certain figure, it'll fade out. It'll just happen. You know, dancers won't come and say, "Hey, how come you don't ever call well the ding dang?"
Right.
They'll just have some of the concentrating on the other part of the dance so much that I don't think they're going to think about it. But if you take them all away, I think that's where you're going to run into a couple saying, "Hey, you know, what happened to all these things?" I'm sure that would be noticeable.
Yeah.
But if we faded them out little by little, I'm sure, you know. Now, for example, dive through, it's still on the teaching list, but I really don't call dive through. I call pass to the center.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of the callers in this area. And so I teach dive through one night to show them what a dive through is. But I never use it, and most other guys don't use it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and do passo, it's okay, but I don't know, do we need do passo? I don't think so.
No. Well, it's like talking with John Jones, and he was making the same comment, really. And he said, you know, there are a lot of calls that we really don't need, like we don't need partner trade and California coral both.
No,
Let's drop one of them. Yeah. I don't care which one, but that type of thing. And he mentioned dive through and pass to the center. Yeah. Another.
Yeah, I agree. I have always, up until this year, been teaching California twirl early on in my class, just because I don't like to teach right and left through before I teach square through. So I'm always looking for ways to accomplish a right and left through. So I'd say pass through California twirl.
Right.
But this year I decided to try it and do a pass through a partner trade, and it worked just as well.
Sure.
I didn't have any more trouble with it. So I do a dive through once in a great while, but there's so many other things that you can use instead of. If you do your homework, that's what it amounts to. I think it's become too easy to call plus, and they're all zeros and equivalents. It sounds like you're doing a great job, but you really not. I mean, well, and I think the other thing too is we as callers get tired of ourselves.
Yeah.
I don't think the dancers get tired of material. We get tired of our material. Right. We call it so often, so many times, and basically the same. I got to tell you that a few years ago, I recorded myself the first dance of the month at my club, and I did the same thing in the next dance. And I thought I was calling the same dance, but it wasn't. Because you call so many dances between when you see that group, when you see them again, that you change subtly each time you do another night.
Yeah.
But when you go back to that first night and then re-record it, total different dance. I mean, there may be some tunes that are same, but it's totally a different dance. And but we call so often that it doesn't seem like we're ever changing.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe what we should look at too, is listen to ourselves as we call and see, what we're doing that makes them happy and what we're doing that doesn't seem to generate any excitement.
That's a very interesting point. I hadn't really thought about it that way. But well. Having been calling for so long, it's kind of a trick question there. What do you find is the appeal to calling square dancing?
I don't know. I enjoy being with people.
Yeah.
So I never really had any difficulty being in front of people. I don't know why, but I just never did, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I got butterflies, and everything else, but. But I felt it was a very comfortable area for me to be in. And I guess during, not my early stages, but probably the early 70s, I probably taught pretty hard, because my philosophy was, if they're going to pay me to dance, I'm going to teach them to dance. And so I probably turned a few people off. But that's the way it was then, and now, of course, I have a totally different attitude, the whole thing is to have fun out there, that's important. The dancers have to win.
Seems to be the common thread of the interviews that I've been making. One thing we've kind of gotten away from, we don't let the dancers win all the time.
Well, one of the things, and I feel sort of the same thing, I think if the call says, this is the right way to go, and I'm going to do it, they're always a little apprehensive, because they think the guy next door is going to do what you just stopped doing, and all the dancers are going to run over him. And I don't think that's going to happen. But I think we all have that sense that, gee, if we're not doing what everybody else is doing, maybe we're going to lose our people, and they really aren't our people. They're dancers, and they go any place they want, but I think we have the feeling that if we're doing something and they're coming to us regularly, then maybe we don't want to change too much, because maybe they'll find something else down the road. But I think, we as an industry, say, or as a group, need to really take a look and get the fun back in dancing, both learning and dancing on the floor, and therefore generate some interest back in the activity, because it is a good activity.
Of course,
it's good. It's good exercise. It's a low impact.
Well, Dave, I really appreciate you taking the time to drop off the interstate and
take
time to sit down and do this.
I enjoy it. I've been doing some speed stuff. talks at some of the associations around. In fact, I just did one at Springfield here at college last week. Sort of doing that, just telling college how it was back then. Because most of the colleges around today, they weren't calling back then. They right. may have been dancing, but they weren't calling back then, you know, when I started. And people still say, oh, I remember when you did this at this place or that place. And I, of course, I don't remember them, but...
Yeah.
And I did call it at something down in Atlantic City one time. I forget who let me do it or whatever, but I called a dance, and it might have been a, oh, what do they call them? When they get the dance, get up and they go in their jams or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Can't remember the name.
Knothead.
Was traveling. Idiots or whatever it was. But anyway, I remember doing something down in Washington, and for like 10 years, people would say, do you remember me? I was down in Washington. I must have 50 squares out there. And they think I'm going to remember.
Sure, right.
Well, they remember me because I'm only one guy.
Right.
But I'm amazed at the number of people. I remember when you did. And, of course, I remember doing it, but I don't remember, like, where.
Yeah, right.
You know, who was there.
You got it. So, well, I'm going to let you get on the road, Dave.
All right.
I really thank you for taking the time to... make this tape, and we'll put it in the archives, and you're now a member of the future generations of posterity.
Okay.
Thanks,
all
Dave.
Right. All right.